Hello, you're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine. On this program, we ask poets to select a poem from the New Yorker archive to read and discuss, along with one of their own poems that's been published in the magazine. My guest today is Peter Balakian, whose honors include the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, the Presidential Medal, and Moses Kornatsi Medal from the Republic of Armenia, and the Spendlov Prize for Social Justice, Tolerance, and Diplomacy. Welcome, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Kevin.
It's really great to have you. The poem you picked is In a Dark Time by Theodore Rettke. Can you tell us why this particular poem stood out to you from the archive?
You know, it's one of Rettke's late poems, and I find Rettke a powerful figure from mid-20th century American poetry and poetry in English. And this poem strikes me as having a kind of urgency and what I might even call an existential richness to it that gives it an enduring power. I first encountered this poem in the early 1970s, and it's a poem that has stayed with me over the decades, a poem I continue to teach. And I've written about Rettke, and this is a poem I've also written about.
Let's hear it. Here's Peter Balakian reading In a Dark Time by Theodore Rettke.
In a dark time, one. In a dark time, the eye begins to see. I meet my shadow in the deepening shade. I hear my echo in the echoing wood. A lord of nature weeping to a tree. I live between the heron and the wren, beasts of the hill, serpents of the den. Two. What's madness but nobility of soul at odds with circumstance? The day's on fire. I know the purity of pure despair, my shadow pinned against a sweating wall. That place among the rocks, is it a cave or winding path? The edge is what I have. Three. A steady storm of correspondences, a night flowing with birds, a ragged moon, and in broad day the midnight come again. A man goes far to find out what he is, death of the self in a long, tearless night, all natural shapes blazing unnatural light. Four. Dark, dark my light, and darker my desire. My soul, like some heat-maddened summer fly, keeps buzzing at the sill. Which eye is I? A fallen man, I climb out of my fear. The mind enters itself, and God the mind. And one is one, free in the tearing wind.
That was In a Dark Time by Theodore Rettke, which appeared originally in the January 16, 1960 issue of the magazine, and again in the December 3, 2018 New York Stories archival issue. So tell me about this poem. One thing we should say is that in the book that this poem eventually appeared in, there are no numbers, but it appeared with numbers in the magazine. Obviously, you read it so well that hearing the numbers, it has a kind of majesty that if it was all one thing, I think it would feel different. I'm not saying it's better or worse, but there's something about those numbers and that, you know, starting over again, you really hear that wren and den. And is it a cave or winding path? The edge is what I have. That's one of the great lines.
Extraordinary, yes. Well, you know, it's interesting, Kevin, the idea that Rettke had numbers in there originally. The larger group of poems, In a Dark Time, commences, and these appeared in Rettke's final book, 1963, called A Far Field. The sequence is called, the group of poems is called Sequence, sometimes metaphysical, and I think that Rettke was thinking sequentially when he wrote this poem. And obviously, he started with numbers as a kind of way to orchestrate four movements in a very powerful meditation. And I even find the notion of sometimes metaphysical very rich for this poem, which seems to move between the metaphysical and the organic and the psychological.
Right. And, you know, as Berryman called him, the garden master. He always has that sort of natural world at hand there, Rutke. But there's something, you know, as you say, metaphysical about it. It's about human nature, the nature that he sees, I find.
It's very much an interesting dialectic between, the psychological self, the natural world, and the possibility of transcendence. Mm. And, you know, Rethke once wrote back in the mid-1940s when he was beginning his famous Greenhouse poems, which I think are the great kind of breakthrough poems for him in his career. He wrote, "I wanted to write a poem, the shape of the psyche under great stress." He was a man who suffered severe bipolar disorder. He went through electroshock therapy. He really did know the depth of mental anguish and suffering.
That's right.
And he takes that, I think he uses that so powerfully in this poem. It's not a poem in which he's parading his psychiatric conditions on his sleeve, but in which he's so masterfully absorbed his mental suffering into a larger, broader human struggle to find release and transcendence and wholeness.
Yeah. No, and I think there's a procession, if not a progression, through that, you know? And in a dark time, the eye begins to see. That's a really interesting starting point. And it's very personal, as you say. Death of the self in a long, tearless night, all natural shapes blazing unnatural light. That contrast between dark and light, which he's playing with, can get, you know, frankly, overused. But yes. He somehow renews it, I think, in this poem. And the other thing I felt reading it in the light of day, as it were, it was also about dark times, if you know what I mean, and not like just his personal struggle, but a kind of public political struggle.
I think
even.
That's right. And, you know, you're noting that, Kevin, reminds me that my good friend Robert J. Lifton, the psychiatrist and historian who has written, you know, 24 books on mass violence and dark times, always quotes the opening of this poem at the end of his lectures, because he as you're noting, he also sees a universal emblem in that opening line, and it's also a hopeful one, you know, because I think Rethke, from the start of this poem, is noting the dialectic between suffering, hope, and light, and then in the end of this particular poem, there is a kind of catharsis and freedom that happens, which I think gives this poem an enormous psychological power.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Rutke is sometimes less remembered, let's say, of the, quote, confessional poets. But he was really early to write about some of these questions. And I think one of the best at enacting what used to be called madness. You know, there's this kind of way in which he's able to think about, as you put it, mental anguish, but not as a descriptor, but as a process. Those sections, I remember when I would have students who were trying to do something kind of big, kind of bold, but I would say, go read Rutke, but don't read the stuff that's in the anthologies. You must go to the actual books where those sequences are enacting and thinking about the poem as a mind, as you say, like sort of at war with itself.
I think that's right, Kevin. And one of the reasons I chose this poem is also because I agree with you. I think Rethke is way underread today. And I think that his best poems really are large and enduring. This is one of them. And he is, and I've argued this in a piece I've written about Rethke, that I think he is the first confessional, if that matters, in a sense of historicity. I think that the Greenhouse poems of the mid and late 1940s broke ground in merging what I like to call the ontogenetic and the phylogenetic. I mean, moving between, you know, the anguish of the self and a sense of an archetypal natural world out there. And other poets would move into that zone, Lowell, Berryman, Plath, Sexton, very, very shortly thereafter. But for the sake of history, it's worth noting what Rettke did in the 1940s for American poetics and those Lost Son poems.
Yeah.
That I think you're noting here when you say that those poems enact such an extraordinary psychological processes of discovery and unfolding, and they're never didactic. They're always about the self in motion. So
right.
I always want to recommend to our listeners, just read The Lost Son, the first poem in that
yeah,
cycle. Wow,
yeah,
that's
amazing.
An amazing piece of work.
And Plath, she credited him, right, and was very clear about that her transformation in many ways was thinking about his poems.
Very much, yeah. I think she found a lot of energy in Rettke's organic psychic energy. You know, I think of her poem like Ariel or Tulips. Those poems have that, I keep using the word archetypal because Rettke was very interested in Jung. And he's bringing Jung into poetics and his own poems, I think in an organic way, not in an academic way. And I think she really liked that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, do you think it's that, you know, his disciples, as it were, I mean, the wrong word, but surpassed him as a poet? Or why do you think he is forgotten?
You know, it's
and he's not forgotten, but like, why isn't he, the person we're like talking about when we think of confessional? He's the last person we perhaps think
of. You know,
of.
I think you hit on something just a moment ago, Kevin, when you were mentioning your remarks to your students. I feel that Rettke is anthologized poorly.
Yeah.
He's anthologized by more of his mid-50s Yeatsian formal poems. Now, this is also a formal poem, and I want to say something about how powerful I think this poem is formally.
Yes, yes.
But I do think that the most experimental and dynamic Rettke is an anthologized.
Right. That's the thing, is I think you nailed it. He's very experimental. People don't realize that. You read the Rettke in the anthology, you're like, well, he likes greenhouses. He's on the top of the house.
You right, right.
But you dig a little deeper, and you'll say, wow, he is really trying to see how language can exist without verb, or language
yes.
can exist that's only verb. You know, he's really thinking about language
he
as
is.
A medium.
Very much the plasticity and the oral, the kind of oral rhymes. And, you know, Rettke at one point said, my true ancestors are the Bible and Mother Goose. So
really
he wanted to really massage the infantile intensity of syntax.
Yeah. And doesn't he have great kids' poems? Isn't that right?
He does. He
yeah.
has those poems for poems based on animals for children called I Am, Says the Lamb.
What a great title.
Yeah. Yeah, the great poems.
No, and that's I have a personal soft spot for children's books by poets, which I think are a genre unto themselves. And, you know, everyone from James Baldwin to Elizabeth Bishop have these children's books, you know, who
Eliot, too, with his cat's poems.
Of course, yeah, of course. Yeah. And there's a sort of charm, but also, you know, a Mother Goose that they're learning from also in their, quote, adult poetry.
And one of my favorite nursery jingles in Rettke's Lost Son poem goes, even Stephen, all is lest, I haven't time for sugar. Put your finger in your nose and there will be a booger. So,
there you have it.
He did this stuff and right in the middle of a poem. He had called jump rope language.
Well, that's so interesting.
Powerful.
And so tell us about the more formal aspects of this poem because, you know, we're talking about Mother Goose, but this is, you know, Mother Goose on something.
You know, Kevin, I feel that the rhyming in this poem is really brilliant. These are 4 6-line stanzas going A, B, B, A, C, C. And the rhymes, for example, like shade and tree or despair
and fire.
And fire. They're really subtle rhymes. And there's also mind and wind closing the poem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have that Dickinsonian slantness to them.
Yes.
They're a little less slant. They're somewhere between slant and perfect, but they're beautiful and
right.
they're rich. And they create a kind of acoustic for this poem that is so accomplished
yeah.
and memorable.
And they have another way to think of it for our readers might be they visually look like they write more than they do sometimes.
Yes.
And so there's this kind of tension, I think, that also is part of the point of the poem, which is things aren't always what they seem. You know, they seem one way, but as we were talking about, the eye begins to see there's something else. And I love that moment where he says, which eye is I? And we return to the EYE and the eye of the poem. And I'm really, you know, trying to work out what that is in a poem, because I think a poem is always obsessed with that switch between the self and the thing that sees.
Absolutely. And there are two things that I was going to note in response to what you're saying. One is that this is a poem in which the poet is not afraid of taking risks with big language. And there are times when, you know, I like to talk to my students about rhetoric and poetry and those big risk moments and how hard they are to pull off and how they need to be set up. Rettke here at the peak of his powers in this poem is taking enormous risks with large rhetorical gestures. I know the purity of pure despair, which I is I. The mind enters itself in God, the mind. Rettke never used the word God, rarely used the word God in his poem. I think Rettke was a spiritual poet, but he wasn't orthodoxly religious. But here he takes that risk with that big word. So it has that, or what's madness but nobility of soul at odds with circumstance? You know, there are many days when I walk around saying those lines. I mean, they're Shakespearean, you know?
Well, and in Shakespeare, in Rettke, and sort of in our time, saying the truth or saying these things can feel, you know, Shakespeare gives the madmen, the clowns, the truest lines, of course, in the plays. And here he's observing this thing that may be true of us. I mean, we're in this crazy moment where it seems like someone telling the truth is crazy.
No, you're absolutely
it's
right.
It's madness, you know? And so there's this really interesting comment on our times.
And I think that's the kind of thing that poetry can do and does do. You know, it gives us language that is, to quote Kenneth Burke's phrase, that's language that's equipment for living. And I think this poem is equipment for living in many ways. And in dark times, and we're in some hard times here, and this poem may not be pointedly political, but what's so rich about its dimensions is that it does provide us with rhetoric that's meaningful and insightful and powerful in a time that may be difficult, both socially, politically, or personally.
Sure. Now, in the May 28th, 2018 issue, The New Yorker published your poem Eggplant, which we'll hear you read in a moment. Is there anything you'd like to say about this poem? How did it come to you? Why, you know, let's talk about it just briefly before we launch into it.
The poem is part of a cycle of poems I've been writing that are kind of, I don't know, object meditations on fruits and vegetables. And I think this is one of the kind of important places for poetic imagination. So many poets are engaged in object meditations, whether they be on paintings, on architecture, on works of art, on fruits and vegetables.
Still lives, in a way.
Yeah, they're kind of still lives. And then as we engage in the meditation, we find that the thing or the object takes us to places that surprise us.
Wonderful. Let's hear this poem. Here's Peter Balakian reading his poem, Eggplant.
Eggplant. I love the white moon circles and the purple halos on a plate as the salt sweat them. The oil in the pan smoked like bad days in the Syrian desert, when a moon stayed all day, when morning was a purple elegy for the last friend seen, when the fog of the riverbank rose like a holy ghost. My mother made those white moons sizzle in some egg wash and salt. Some parsley appeared from the garden, and summer evenings came with no memory but the table with white dishes. Shining aubergine, black-skinned beauty, bitter apple. We used our hands.
Mm. That was Eggplant by Peter Balakian.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
That poem is so subtly powerful, I think. I love that moment where it says, came with no memory, but. So tell me about that, the no memory and the but, because it seems like that's part of it. Is it that the moment is so vivid it's not a memory, or that one's alive in the moment, or is it that everything boils down to this table with white dishes?
Well, that word memory is a kind of fulcrum word for the poem because although I start the poem, remembering the eggplants being cut in my kitchen, in my mother's kitchen in suburban New Jersey, say when I was 10 years old in the early 1960s or something, immediately the image of the eggplant evokes something dark and traumatic in our family and culture's past. And so the image of the Syrian desert takes my memory back to the Armenian genocide. And although my grandmother doesn't appear in this poem in a trope or an image, her experience as an Armenian genocide death march survivor is evoked with that image of this vegetable, which is very much a staple in the Armenian, the Armenian cuisine, but it also becomes a historical emblem. The elegy for the last Francine and the fog on the riverbank like a holy ghost and so on, that's evoking hard times.
So food is never just food, is it?
That's right.
Well, it's interesting because I write about food. Food appears in poems of mine. Is this, an ode, or do you think of it that way? Or is it, you called it a meditation, which I like that idea. And how are they different? For me, you're not just praising this eggplant, which I think praise is complex. If you're just praising, you have to praise something that, is worthy of praise, but also maybe unexpected. When Yusuf has Ode to the Maggot, then right. You're thinking right. about this right. lowly thing that is yes. huge. And I think what I love about you using the eggplant is, as you said, it's a staple. It means something in this cuisine, but it also means something else in this poem.
Yeah, so I appreciate your noting the differences between the ode and the meditation, I think they also, maybe in this poem, there's a little overlapping because there is a praise of the beauty, just the sensuous beauty of this natural world, the eggplant, a piece of the natural world, and its color, which still, when I slice them once a week on my own cutting board, because I cook a lot, they still speak back to me.
Right, right.
And I close the poem with the praise of the eggplant. But as you're also noting, I guess what I'd say is that the meditation might move in places that are a little wilder, more unexpected, perhaps. And so that the poem, the eggplant as a beautiful emanation of nature, also catapults me, my imagination, back into the historical.
Mm-hmm.
That's the meditative part of it, perhaps.
Yeah.
Both are going on, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I love the simplicity both of the poem and of the dish. Some egg wash and salt, some parsley appeared from the garden. That's a lovely
Thank you.
image. But then this last one, and I want to think about it just for a little bit longer. Shining aubergine, black-skinned, break, beauty, bitter apple. What a great, great word. I want to start calling them bitter apples. But also all those words from skin to beauty to the apple, the sort of Eden quality,
sure.
pre-Lapsarian.
Yes, sure, yes.
That's there, you know. And then we used our hands. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I appreciate and love listening to you reflect on those two lines that precede the last line in which I want to just linger. I think it's one of the things that the poetic imagination does so much of the time. It's lingering on the layers of the sensual world. And this is why poetry, and I'm not just referring to me here, you know, just poetry in a broad sense, brings us such profound and indispensable knowledge of reality, you know, because poems do this. They, you know, we as poets get obsessed with the complex layers of things. But okay, I go on too far, too much here.
No,
but,
that's perfect.
But in the end, I guess we used our hands became a kind of image of passion and, unmediated love of ingesting this beautiful food and this beautifully prepared vegetable. And so that I didn't want there to be any mediating reality, like a cold metal fork or knife.
When you put it that way, it sounds, why do we use these things, you know?
I always feel the Asian culture has it better because they at least have wood, and wood is a more organic way. But sometimes you just need to use your hands.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, for the things we love.
Yeah. I want to ask just sort of lastly, what else appears in this, in your garden of verses that you're sort of working toward, the sequence?
I have a range of vegetables in this sequence that include some things that are really, I find, located in a Armenian Middle Eastern terrain, like quince and apricot. I mean, apricot's universal, but it's Armenia's national fruit. But tomatoes, zucchinis, cracked wheat, bulgur, which is something we grew up eating a lot of, cracked wheat. And it's some things that are very American, too, but a variety, walnuts, grape leaves. It's been fun to, I mean, this is one small segment of a longer book I'm completing now.
Are these poems at the heart of it, or the whole thing one meditation on this? Or?
No, I'd say these are a group of poems that have their own kind of space in a book that has a few layers to it, including one more, because my two previous books have two 50-section multi-sequence poems, and I have one more sort of 45, 50-section long poem to finish what I've been working on for about 15 or 20 years now, this trilogy that I call my Ziggurat Trilogy.
That's amazing. Tell me just a little bit more about that, the Ziggurat Trilogy for you.
Well, the Ziggurat Trilogy began with the poem of 45 sections or so in my book of 2010 called Ziggurat, and that poem is called A Train Ziggurat Elegy. And the next installment of that was Ozone Journal. And
that was 2016.
That was 2015.
And then you won in 2016 for that book.
And the new one, I'll leave the title off.
Fair enough.
Till it's absolutely sealed. But I would say in these poems, and they're all set in Manhattan. And in fact, the first poem, A Train Ziggurat Elegy, a lot of it is set in Manhattan and in Lower Manhattan during an era of the 1970s when I was commuting down here and the city was in another phase of its evolution. And I started writing the A Train Ziggurat Elegy poem after the World Trade Towers came down. And my shock and my engagement with the towers had to do with my feeling of intimacy with them, having been a mail runner, mail deliverer, mail guy for a shipping company. And I was in the towers a lot as a young guy, as a teenager and college student. And now their absence really haunted me, as they haunted all of us. So that was some animating impetus for that poem. That poem has many layers to it. And both Ozone and Ziggurat move between the Middle East and New York City. And in Ozone Journal, a piece of that poem is situated with the persona. I always like to use the word persona.
Yeah, because exactly. Especially when it's very personal. One has to say persona.
It's not a memoir, even right. though it's personal.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We all know that. But readers sometimes think, oh, this is your life story. Well, yeah, piece of it maybe.
Yeah,
but,
sure, right.
But the autobiographical piece was that I was on a forensic dig with a 60 Minutes crew doing a segment for 60 Minutes in 2009, and we were digging up the remains of Armenian bones in the Syrian desert in a place called Deir Zor, which was the epicenter of death during the Armenian genocide in 1915. And so I have a little dialectical piece right. that moves between Syria and New York City in that poem.
Yeah.
And now in this third poem, I'm picking up various threads, but the cultural, political tensions in this poem, in a new poem, the new sequential 50-section poem, are centered around the geological history of the planet and some climate change engagements. I'll just say that very generally.
Sure. Well, I look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
Peter, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Kevin, thank you. It's been great being here.
Eggplant by Peter Balakian, as well as Theodore Rutke's poem In a Dark Time, can be found on NewYorker.com. In a Dark Time is from the collected poems of Theodore Rutke, published by Anchor Books, a division of Penguin Random House. Peter Balakian's latest book is Ozone Journal. Thanks so much.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Rope-A-Dope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Eisenman.